The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show, sponsored by Legacy Precious Metals. There's never been a better time to invest in precious metals. Visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to Wednesday. What is God doing? That's always my question. What is God doing? God is doing things in this world right now. And people need to know that that it's our obligation to have hope. We have an obligation to be hopeful and to look forward and to ask ourselves, what is God doing? Not just to say, oh, everything's falling apart. No. First of all, that's not true. God allows difficult things to happen, often to wake us up, to bless us, to help us, to get on the right track if we've been on the wrong track. Now, part of that, I've got a lot to share here. My guest in the first hour today and in most of the second hour today is a very old friend. It's amazing how many years it's been. Jim Kunstler. Jim, he goes officially by James Howard Kunstler, somebody I met in 1986. Brilliant writer, brilliant thinker, an out-of-the-box thinker. I think a Democrat for much of his life, or certainly no kind of conservative Christian or anything. But during crazy times, there's some heroic people who are real free thinkers who think for themselves, and they begin to see things and to say things. And Jim Kunstler is one of those folks. So this is kind of a rambling conversation that I have with him, but what's amazing to me is people that I would have differed with politically or theologically years ago, or even in some ways now, they are still seeing some things that the mainstream media refuses to talk about. The evil of this vaccine, pushing these vaccines, the evil of so many of these narratives, the lie of this election, how we're told not to talk about this, to get over it, to shut up. You're a conspiracy theorist. You're an insurrectionist. So Jim Kunstler is an amazing guy. Now, I just want to say, too, that he is, I can't say this with him on the air, so I'll say it now before he comes on the air. He's really brilliant. His writing is not just brilliant and forward-thinking. I'm not saying I agree with everything he says, but most of what he says. But he's very entertaining. After we did this interview last week, Suzanne and I went to hear him on the upper East Side, not too far from where we live. And he just gave the most amazing talk. So he's just somebody that I want you to be familiar with. There are a lot of these folks out there that maybe I don't agree with them on everything, but they're brave and they have good souls. And Jim Kunstler is one of those. So I'm excited to introduce him. He's been on the program before, but not in the studio. So this is his my conversation with him in the studio from last week. Now, Alvin, we've got a couple of other crazy things. I have a very funny letter to share. I guess I will save that for the end of this segment, but from a 15-year-old who emailed me. I want to read that letter in a minute. Before that, let me remind you, August 3rd, that's today, August 4th tomorrow, August 5th, we are, and also August 8th, we're taping the late night talk show with Eric Metaxas at the TBN studios. If you can get here, which is to say by 4 p.m. ish, any of these nights, the 3rd, the 4th, the 5th, and the 8th, it's going to be nuts. I just want to tell you, go to my website, ericmetaxas.com. You can click on speaking or schedule, and it'll show you how to get your name on there. But if you can come to New York, it's off of Union Square, it's going to be a blast. And I just want anybody who can be a part of it, whether you can do that today, tomorrow, Friday, or Monday, or any of those days. If you live in New York, you're welcome to come every one of those days, but you got to get signed up because the theater is limited. Also have to say, Albin, two quick things before I get to this funny letter, crazy letter. SalemNow.com, we have a new movie out called Uncle Tom. Our friend Larry Elder made Uncle Tom the documentary about his experience and the experience of Black Americans, what it is to grow up in this country and to live with this leftist Marxist narrative that's taken over since the death of Dr. King over 50 years ago, and to talk about the truth. So Uncle Tom, the sequel, Uncle Tom 2, is now out. So we want you to go to SalemNow.com, check out Uncle Tom 2. There's a lot of other important stuff there that you can find at SalemNow.com. And finally, I want to remind you, we're doing an all-out fundraiser with Food for the Poor. You know that a couple times a year we partner with them. There's a lot of suffering in the world, and I simply want to say that God asks us to give, to do what we can to help those who are suffering. And so we ask you to give financially, whatever you can give, folks. It doesn't matter. Some people can give a lot. If you can give a little, we're grateful to you. You can go to MetaxasTalk.com. When you go to MetaxasTalk.com, you'll see the banner. There's all kinds of other fun stuff at MetaxasTalk.com, but there's a banner there, and we want you to click on that banner. If you'd like to call, we'll give you the phone number. But the bottom line is this. There are human beings suffering because of the war in Ukraine. We know that suffering is suffering, that if you were suffering, if you couldn't feed yourself, if you couldn't feed your kids, you'd hope that somebody out there, some person who maybe claims to be a Christian, would say, well, I'd like to help. What can I do? This is an opportunity for us to show the love of God and basically to obey God in our giving and to do what we can to help those who are suffering. So I want to ask you to go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, or if it's easier, of course, the telephone, the number, I will say it slowly, 844-863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE, or 844-863-4673, 844-863-4673. The need is great. I'm simply asking you to do what you can. I also want to say that anybody who is privileged to be able to give $10,000, which is, of course, tax deductible, to this important cause and this organization, Food for the Poor, which we've partnered with many times. If you're able to do that, we want to thank you by spending the evening with you. If you're in New York or I'm in your city, I've done this many times, and I just love meeting the people who they're not just able to give $10,000, they give. It's an amazing thing to me. Some of them are very wealthy. Some of them are not that wealthy, but they decide this is what we want to do. And it moves my heart. And it's always an honor for me to spend an evening with those folks. I've met many new friends that way, to be quite honest. I'm just amazed you meet these people that they're living out their faith. They don't just talk about it. And so whatever you can give, we want you to give. Anybody who can give $10,000, I'm asking you bluntly, please do it, because the need is huge at Food for the Poor to help these folks. But whatever you can give, we want to ask you to give. And whatever you do give, we will put your name in a hat, and we will draw out a bunch of random grand prize winners. We're going to send you signed books and all kinds of fun stuff. So we want you to do that. The phone number again, 844-863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE. We need to hit this hard this week, folks. We need to hit this hard this week. Now I get to read the fun letter.
Yes.
Hi, Eric. This is Ethan from Colorado. I am 15. I had the privilege to meet you in Colorado Springs when you signed my pillow. He means this is, I posted this on social media. A young kid and his brother came with a My Pillow without the cover and said, will you sign my pillow? I just howled. I had a picture. I have put a picture of them on Twitter and stuff. I signed it. He says, I want to thank you for the great impact you've had on my life through your radio show. You've woken me up to the truth about our country and helped me in my walk with God through your teachings about the clear evidence of God. Thank you for all the work you do. And I hope I get the chance to see you again. P.S. I'm excited for your new book, Letter to the American Church, and I'm going to pre-order it, sadly, without the code Eric. That, listen, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to know how I keep it together, meeting people like young Ethan in Colorado Springs and others and getting letters like this, I read it all. I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. We're in a journey together. We're doing this together. We're all playing our part. As I said, do what you can. We've got a lot of exciting programming coming up. Stick around for Jim Kunstler. And don't forget, please go to MetaxasTalk.com because we need your help. Thank you. In case you haven't been paying attention, the Biden administration has caused a financial crisis and they have no clue how to fix it. Oil prices have skyrocketed, and when oil prices go up, the cost of transportation and shipping spikes, leading the prices of goods to rise. And when we're already seeing record inflation, that's the last thing we need. Our economy is in trouble, and you need to take steps to protect yourself. If all your money is tied up in stocks, bonds, and traditional markets, you are vulnerable. Gold is one of the best ways to protect your retirement. No matter what happens, you own your gold. It is real. It is physical. It's always been valuable since the dawn of time. Legacy Precious Metals is the company I trust for investing in gold. They can help you roll your retirement account into a gold-backed IRA where you still own the physical gold. They can also ship gold and precious metals safely and securely to your house. Call Legacy at 866-528-1903 or visit them online at legacypminvestments.com.
Tell me, Eric, why is Relief Factor so successful at lowering or eliminating pain? I'm often asked that question. The owners of Relief Factor tell me they believe our bodies were designed to heal. That's right, designed to heal, and I agree with them. So the doctors who formulated Relief Factor for them selected the four best ingredients, yes, 100% drug-free ingredients. Each helps your body deal with inflammation. Each of the four ingredients deals with inflammation from a different metabolic pathway. And that right there, approaching from four different angles, may be why so many people find such wonderful relief. So if you've got back pain, shoulder, neck, hip, knee, or foot pain from exercise or just getting older, you should order the three-week quick start discounted to only $19.95 to see if it will work for you. It works for me. It has for about 70% of the 500,000 people who've tried it and have ordered more. Go to relieffactor.com or call 800-4-RELIEF to find out about this offer. Feel the difference.
Uh-oh. Folks, it's time to start. Where do I begin? I have to say that I'm sitting here with an old friend. It's hard to believe how long it's been. I'm sitting here with James Howard Kunstler, who lets me call him Jimbo. Jimbo, or Jim, you and I have not been in the same room since probably Christmas 91.
Well, we veered into very different kind of intellectual trenches. And, you know, digging ourselves deeper into them so we can't see over the top.
But it's still crazy to me because you've been on the program before, you know, via Skype or whatever. But I met you when I was at Yaddo in 1986.
Yeah, originally with Alan Chews, I think.
Alan.
We were watching the 1986 World Series at my house.
That's right.
A tragic series.
That's exactly right. It wasn't tragic for Mets fans.
Right, not for them. But
I was born in Queens, a mile from Shea Stadium, so it was not tragic for me.
Oh.
But the point is, that was 1986. I was 23, and I was at Yaddo, which was a huge deal for me, because obviously I want to be a literary writer, and I got to go to Yaddo where Cheever was. So it meant so much to me. But I met this guy named Alan Chews. And Alan says, now, Al, how do you describe him? Alan was...
Well, he was a big kind of bear of a guy. He was a book critic and a professor, and he had an NPR book show.
Right.
And he was a sweet fellow.
Oh, yeah, very sweet. And he was very kind to me because he said, hey, you want to come with me? I know somebody who lives near here, a writer named Jim Kunstler. And so he drags me along, the 23-year-old version of me, along with him to meet you. And... I instantly loved you and started reading your books. It's totally true.
I got a funny Yaddo story for you, though. I never went to the place as a guest because there was no point to it. I lived in Saratoga Springs, where the place was, and I had no problem working at home. So there was no point in me moving, you know, a mile and a half down the road to an arts colony. But I did fill in for a friend of mine as the chef during the winter season when she went on vacation. And they had a much reduced number of...
That's when I was there.
Yeah. Okay. They had.
I was expecting to go to the big house, but they said, no. We're just doing... This is the winter season. So there was only about, 18 people or 16 people at the time. And so you actually cooked for those artists.
Yeah, and, it can get kind of dismal there at that time of year, especially if you have, a bad crew of artists, a cranky bunch of, antisocial people. So some of the writers used to come in late in the afternoon when the sun was going down in November or December to talk to me. And I got a note in my employee box that said, don't consort with the guests.
Yeah.
You're
the riffraff. Keep away.
But the ironic thing was I'd published more books at that time than most of the people who were coming in to talk to me.
Well, of course. I have to say this for my audience because I know my audience well enough. If you're wondering what we're talking about, in my book, Fish Out of Water, the story of my life up until my 25th birthday, I talk about being at Yaddo. And it's hard... It really is hard to explain. And by the way, look, I want to introduce you at least properly initially here and say that you've written a ton of books. You have a lot to say on a lot of subjects. I want to get to all of that. I recommended to my audience last time you hear your book, The Geography of Nowhere, which really changed the way I think about a lot of stuff. And Suzanne, my wife, she may be showing up here to meet you. But really, you've just done tons of stuff. You're extremely talented. But I met you at Yaddo. I was just a kid who wanted to be a fiction writer. And we have to explain. I think I explain this in my book, Fish Out of Water. But it's a bizarre concept. It's an artist colony where people go to have, 6 or 8 weeks of quiet time so they can work on their art. But the reality is kind of weird.
Yeah, like a lot of people get thrown out of their usual routines, which are, provide a safe and comfortable scaffold for their artistic lives, and they end up in the woods not knowing what to do.
Well, that's exactly right. I have to tell you that...
That's one of the reasons I never did it.
It's not only that, but it's kind of like a... People often who are just lost in life, they go there kind of hoping maybe to hook up, to meet somebody.
Are you kidding?
No.
That's mostly what people did there, I think.
Well, no, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I picked that up, and I know I write about this in my book, that there was some 60-ish composer, and I remember at the table, we have this conversation at dinner, right? And he said, I have an open marriage. Like, he made that very clear for the women at the table in case, yes, I'm married technically, but obviously I'm here, for other things and stuff. But it was like such a bizarre scene. And it was like something that probably I should write about at some point in depth, because as a naive 23-year-old to step into this horrible, weird situation of cynical artists. Anyway, it was so weird. But that's what I get to meet you. And so all these years later, I've been reading your stuff, and I always put guests on the spot, say, how do you describe yourself? You're so complicated and so eclectic. So if somebody says to you, hey, who are you?
I'm a full-service writer.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. I have written a ton of fiction, probably 13 novels, and I've published, six nonfiction books, maybe seven. I lost count. And... I've been a journalist, and I'm not a college professor, thank God. I escaped that dreadful, ignominious fate. And now I'm a blogger, having made, a kind of a transition between the increasingly janky and sketchy book publishing world and the internet, which does furnish somebody with a way to make a living. If you play it right. Yeah. And so I'm playing it. And I put out a blog twice a week on Monday and Friday. And it's a popular political blog. I've got a pretty good readership. And I really enjoy writing it. I get up at 5:30 in the morning. And it's like doing a piece of chamber music, only with, paragraphs.
It's like playing etudes on your flute.
Yeah.
I think I remember that phrase from the geography, from
An Embarrassment of Riches, your novel.
Oh, that was a crazy book.
Yeah. No, you've listen, I just want my audience to know that you're a brilliant writer. You're very, very, very funny. You write very, very hilariously.
And don't forget.
Which is hard to do.
I bake cookies and make my own clothes.
And you bake cookies and make your own clothes. So you, you were a writer for Rolling Stone a long time ago.
Yeah. I was, a professional journalist at a time when Rolling Stone was trying to professionalize its operation in 1974, and they were throwing a lot of hippie deadweight overboard and looking for young newspaper people who had some experience, and I got picked. I didn't like the job very much. I lasted there about a year, and I made a very concerted, determined decision to drop out and segue into writing books. It was that time of my life. I was 26 years old. And, you know, that's kind of a time when a young man feels that he has to get serious about doing whatever it was that he aspired to. So I dropped out. I moved to a very nice, comfortable small town in upstate New York, Saratoga Springs, where I'd lived briefly as a newspaper reporter before Rolling Stone. And I settled into, about a 20-year period of grinding out books.
So you... Now, your path is interesting because you, you were writing these hilarious novels and things. But when I was working at Rabbit Ears.
Yeah.
However,
I hadn't published any nonfiction at that point.
Right. Oh, no. This is before your nonfiction phase, which is now principally how I know you as a writer of these serious, important, genuinely books. And I was at Rabbit Ears. I was like editorial director. We're writing all these children's books. We're adapting folk tales and this and that. We're getting famous people to record them. Anybody who is familiar with my Rabbit Ears career, I wrote, 20 books for them. But then I had the privilege of editing the ones that I didn't write and thinking like, hey, do I know any writers that could do? So I turned to you and you wrote the story on Davy Crockett.
I did a whole American folklore series. I think I did Davy Crockett and Annie Oakley.
Sacagawea.
And, about 20 years later, I ran into David Lindley at a folk cafe. David Lindley, the musician, the L.A. session musician who plays with Ry Cooter.
That one.
And he did the music for Sacagawea. And it was this lovely kind of, early 19th century dance music and fiddle music mainly.
Well, we should explain Rabbit Ears. They would, there'd be a book, a text. So I was in charge of these books.
Yeah.
But then they would find like a top Hollywood star to read to narrate it. Oh, we're out of time. We'll be this is the 10:30. This is not the 9:30. So we have time. But when we come back, we will continue the conversation with James Howard Kunstler. Don't go away. MyPillow is having their biggest sheet sale of the year. You've all helped build MyPillow into the amazing company it is today. Now, Mike Lindell, inventor and CEO, wants to give back exclusively to his listeners. The Percale bed sheet set is available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they're all on sale. For example, the queen size, regularly priced at $89.98, is now only $39.98 with our listener promo code Eric. Order now, because when they're gone, they're gone. The Percale sheets are breathable. They've got a cool, crisp feel. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Don't miss out on this incredible offer. There's a limited supply, so be sure to order now. Call 1-800-978-3057, 1-800-978-3057. Use the promo code ERIC or just go to MyPillow.com, MyPillow.com. Click on the radio listener square. Use the promo code ERIC. The offer will not last very long because these Percale sheets are known to sell very quickly. Order now with promo code ERIC at MyPillow.com. That's MyPillow.com. Promo code ERIC. Folks, welcome back. I'm talking to James Howard Kunstler, also known as Jimmy Jimbo.
Jimmy Jack.
Jim.
Reverend Jimmy Jack.
You. So we were just talking about rabbit ears. So, yeah. So in the late 80s, early 90s, I got this job as editorial director of Rabbit Ears. And I thought, who could I turn to who could, you know, write these stories? So you did, you know, just great work. And Rabbit Ears would, you know, so we'd create this, like, children's book. But then we get top Hollywood names to record them. I think the Davy Crockett was like Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, I think so.
And Sacagawea, I don't remember who did that one.
Yeah,
but
remember.
I'm pretty sure it was Moms Mabley. I'm almost certain.
That I doubt.
It was either Moms Mabley or Sinatra. Either one. One of those two. But then we would get amazing musicians.
You got Garrison Keillor.
Yeah.
Can you use his name now? Is it safe to say Garrison Keillor?
I think he once touched a woman's back.
Something
when
like
they
that.
Were taking a photo, and he lost his career over that. Thank goodness. Those
by the
scary
way,
people.
Mark O'Connor, the fabulous Mark O'Connor, did the music for that. It was quite a fantastic production of video.
Well, that's the point, is that the Rabbit Ears stuff was super excellent.
Won
tons of awards. So I had the privilege of writing many of those. And, you know, my name is attached to these Grammy Awards for Best Children's Recording 1989 or something like that.
I think I got one too.
Yeah, I know.
From some org.
It's crazy. So, but that's kind of like the last time I saw you in person.
Yeah.
Was 1991. And then I went off into my world. I got married. And next thing I know, I see a book by you called The Geography of Nowhere. And I read it, and my wife read it, and we both said, this is not only great writing, but you're actually talking about something that is so seminally important to the American experience. So can you explain to my audience that has no clue what The Geography of Nowhere is?
Well, it was basically about the fiasco of suburban development in America and what an enormous problem it had created for our country in many dimensions. It was an economic problem. It was a spiritual problem. It was an environmental problem.
But it sounds abstract. And by the way, we will get into politics, folks. But what you wrote in that book gave me a vocabulary to understand what I had always viscerally felt. I never really understood why did the strip malls in America why does it all look ugly? And why do these cute little towns like, you know, Provincetown or Martha's Vineyard, or there are all these places around America that you say in the book people go to for vacations, and those are the places that haven't been screwed up.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. It's true that much of the immersive environment that Americans live in is understood to be ugly, but it's actually much worse than that. And you know, if you ask any audience what the problem is with the American suburban landscape, they'll say the trouble is it's all the same. But that's not really it. The real trouble is it's all the same miserable quality. You know, it's an environment that is tremendously punishing to human neurology and to the human spirit.
But just so that people understand what we're talking about, give us an example of something that's not screwed up, and then let's talk about what we mean when we say, you know, this sprawl and whatever.
Well, so, you know, a human habitat that's not screwed up is generally one that's not dominated by automobiles, that is designed at the human scale. That is composed and assembled with conscious artistry, and that's everything that suburbia lacks. So the immersive ugliness of suburbia is actually entropy made visible.
Okay, you in the book, I don't know if you say this in The Geography of Nowhere, but my takeaway was that once upon a time we had small towns, and in the small towns, the town elders they cared about creating. You know, there'd be a green and there'd be a beautiful bank building.
Well, there was a vocabulary for urban design that was based on the human body and human scale. And once we threw that in the garbage with, you know, and the traffic engineers became literally in charge of all the dimensions of how we lived and the deployment of all of the things on the landscape, then we lost all of that knowledge, all that vocabulary, and we started making a huge number of mistakes, and we produced environments that just destroyed people's minds. And now we can see the result of it.
Well,
you know, we're living in a politically psychotic nation now, after about 70 years of that.
There's no question about that. I think about, I mean, again, this is, I'm just trying to process this for my audience a little bit. But I remember when I was reading your book, I started thinking about this. I thought, everywhere I look, this is true. There were downtowns that were beautiful. And Danbury, Connecticut, where I grew up, it had a downtown. And it had a Civil War monument. And sure. It had some beautiful buildings. And people would go there from wherever they lived. And they would do business and stuff. And over time, the energy and the life and whatever kind of got sucked out of the downtown, and they would create a mall or strip malls or whatever. And so the downtown fell into, this is my favorite Jim Kunstler word, decrepitude.
Decrepitude. Well, I didn't invent it.
I know, but you're the one that popularized it in my mind.
All right. Well, all of that is true, but it's self-evident. I mean, we know it obviously happened. The real question is, what were the effects of it? And one of the principal effects was that it went a long way to destroying the development of children who no longer were able to work out their personal sovereignty issues, their management of their own bodies and time and space. You know, there was a really good podcast with Coleman Hughes and Jonathan Haidt about two weeks ago. And Jonathan Haidt made the observation that because children learn so much from the act of wayfinding in their play, when they're deprived of that in an environment where that they can only use with the assistance of the family chauffeur, you know, mom, then they no longer do any wayfinding in their lives. And it, later on in their adult, adolescent and adult lives, they can't find their way. And
okay,
we're seeing exactly
this
that.
This is our shortest segment. We'll be right back. I'm here with James Howard Kunstler. Jim, you're making this point that, and again, you know this stuff so well that I don't want my audience to miss it. You grew up at a time, I mean, it's not, when we watch like the Little Rascals, the Our Gang comedy, these kids are just running all over, getting into adventures by themselves and mm-hmm. stuff like that. You and even I in the 70s grew up at a time when kids could just wander and figure things out.
Well, I could in my environment, which was Manhattan. I grew up in Manhattan. I didn't like it all that much because, I would have preferred to be out bass fishing and riding motorcycles. But, I was completely unsupervised. Nobody ever asked me where I was going or, suggested it would be a problem. I was going up to Yankee Stadium by myself, when I was 9 years old and coming home.
Weren't you shot and killed at that time?
I'm still here.
Really? Get out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the point, right, is that adults somehow – part of this has to do with the fact that the fabric of the culture, there were other adults out there, so it wasn't likely that
also,
you would be...
Also, I happened to live in two different environments in my early childhood. I was in the suburbs from age 5 to 8. Then my parents got a divorce, and I moved into Manhattan. But, those years of 5 to 8 in the suburbs, that's probably the best time to be a kid in the suburbs because you don't need to intersect with much of adult life. You don't need to be in any kind of a town environment. All you're doing is, playing flies up and cops and robbers, and that's all. But once you get to a certain point beyond that, you need other civic, encounters. And so we've got, 3 or 4 generations of kids who never had that. And, they've now raised kids who never had that. And we have a society full of people who seem to be absolutely anchorless.
And you make the case that it's because the way automobiles dominated the American landscape in such a way that we didn't create environments for people. We create environments to get around in our cars.
Yeah, basically. And, I have what I call my new theory of history, which is that things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time. World War I seemed like a good idea at the time because all the kings of Europe, the monarchs of Europe, thought that they were going to ride off, at the head of the cavalry, and it would be a little 2-month lark during the summer, and it ended up being the slaughter of the trenches for 3 or 4 years. So it turned out to not be such a good idea. It seemed like a good idea at the time in the 1920s, after the First World War, to suburbanize America. And so we set out on this project, and we've been doing it ever since for, you know, 100 years now. And now, we, you know, it's over. Now we're living in a time when it's not such a good idea. Many dynamics are now swirling in our culture and in our politics and our in our economy that are going to compel us to live differently whether we like it or not. So, you know, America is going to be dragged kicking and screaming from this disposition of things. There's going to be a tremendous loss of things that were supposed to be valuable. And the destiny of the suburbs is liable to be, you know, one of three things, or, you know, not mutually exclusive: ruins, slums, or salvage.
Now, why do you say that?
Because we're not going to be able to run suburbia. The business model for running suburbia is broken. But I'd have to add that the business model for running gigantic metroplex cities is also broken, and we're going to have a tremendous problem with them. I wrote a series for the American Conservative in 2020 and 21. I ran for about 18 months, about the nature of these problems. And, in fact, I'm giving a talk on it tonight at a New York club.
I hope to be there.
Oh, well, yeah. So I hope you are. So we have we're in a quandary now where both the business model for the suburban way of life and the business model for the Manhattan way of life are both broken. And we're going to have to make enormous changes that are going to be hard to make, you know. I have to add, of course, as my usual caveat, that our cities exist where they do because they occupy these very important geographical sites. And New York is a hugely important geographical site, has the best harbor on the east coast of North America. And there will be a city here, or at least a very large human settlement. But it's not going to be the New York of Doris Day and Frank Sinatra. It's not even going to be the New York of Donald Trump or of your lifetime and my lifetime. It's going to be a smaller place. The economy of it is going to contract enormously. There are going to be fights over who gets to inhabit the districts that still have some value.
So this sounds, it sounds dystopian.
And it is dystopian.
That's exactly why it sounds dystopian, because it is. And are you, so you're probably described also as a futurist.
Yeah, sometimes I am, because I'm making predictions about things that are going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into politics and things, because you're all over the place in a good way, the way that I love. And but we've seen such dramatic changes in America, even over just the last few years, where I think a lot of people have woken up to the idea that whatever narrative they were buying into, they missed it.
Well, there are a bunch of narratives out there, and we're kind of living in a battle of narratives. And that's sort of the problem, because narratives are not reality. You know, reality is something in and of itself, and it has mandates of its own us.
But some narratives reflect reality. I mean, if you say good country, and when we screw up, we try to get it better, and we're doing a good job, or we're trying to do a good job. And then there's another narrative that says America's evil. And, you know, and there's always truth in every narrative. The question is how much.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to deny that there seems to be something afoot. Now, it has been described as the Gramscian march through the institutions to destroy the cultural life of a society. It quacks a lot like that.
Well, cultural Marxism is a big part of it.
Yeah.
You have to. I mean, I don't know any way around that. It is.
And it's destroying the social fabric of our country and putting us in a very bad place. You'd almost have to describe a great deal of behavior these days as absolutely psychotic.
In a good way.
Not in a good way.
No, in a bad way. In a bad way. All right. You have a personal website, Kunstler.com. Is that
it? Yeah, www.kunstler.com.
Kunstler.com. We'll be right back with James Howard Kunstler.
What it is that holds your life so close to mine. You love the fun.
back talking to James Howard Kunstler, who can be found at kunstler.com. And your blog has a name I can't say on the air. It's Cluster F blank 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 nation.
It's a little naughty.
Cluster F, the actual word. But you write about so much. When did you know, Jim, that you would be a writer? Because you seem to have an amazing facility. I remember when I first met you, I started reading your stuff. I thought, boy, this is a guy writing is not torture for you. You seem to be, seems to be something that you do just well and often and easily.
Yeah, I'm not neurotic about it. I don't suffer from blockages. You know, I don't get into some kind of a neurotic globe of despair. You know, I don't drink very much, hardly at all. Or do drugs much. I really enjoy composition. You know, I get a huge kick out of it, especially the gags that I put together for my blog. Because
what do you mean the gags?
Well, I'm a comic writer. And,
yes, you are. Yes, he is.
And also, you know, it's very important, I think, to know that the kind of baloney that we're confronted with now, culturally and politically, really, the best weapon against it is ridicule. And, you know, it's the unfortunate destiny of the ridiculous to be ridiculed. And we're surrounded by ridiculousness. And so I'm working very hard to heap as much opprobrium and ridicule as possible on it.
Yeah, not encomia, opprobrium. Okay, so you at your blog and everywhere else, you write about all kinds of things, but I still want to know, when did you know? How old were you when you thought, yes, I can write, I want to write? When was this an idea for you?
Oh, when I was a teenager, my stepfather gave me his Royal portable typewriter, and I just enjoyed typing, you know, and then I started thinking about the stuff I wanted to type, and then thoughts started coming out, and then I thought, and then I, you know, and I encountered, I came from a family that read a lot. There were books around. We got the Sunday Herald Tribune, which started publishing Tom Wolfe, you know, who was an electrifying writer in 1965. And, you know, I encountered some other ones. Tom McGuane was a big influence on me. He's largely forgotten these days, but he's still around, and he's a wonderful writer. H.L. Mencken from the early 20th century influenced me a lot because he demonstrated to me at an early age how important it was to compose muscular prose.
What do you mean?
You know, prose that had some real energy and heft and power to it. And especially comic power. So
it's interesting you say that because that's something that appeals to me and to which I aspire in much of my writing. And I do think it is what makes you and to some extent me readable writers, because there's a lot of writing that's not that readable.
Yeah, I know. You just want to yawn and pull a paper bag over your head and try to get a few winks, you know?
But it is odd, though, isn't it, how some stuff kind of sucks you in. You want to keep going.
You bet.
And other stuff you could easily put down.
You know, that was true, I think, of Matt Taibbi at least a couple of years ago when he was deliberately trying to, you know, be funny. I'm not sure that's exactly true anymore, but he has it in him, I'm sure.
Did we ever talk about Ring Lardner Sr.? Are you familiar with his short stories?
Oh, sure.
Sure. Of course you are. But, I mean, literally yesterday, for the first time in maybe 20 years, I read The Golden Honeymoon, which is one of his great...
It's been a longer time for me reading
it. It is so funny that it's almost astonishing what a brilliant... We're going to go to a break here, but... What a funny, funny, funny writer, just brilliantly funny writer Ring Lardner Sr. was. We're talking to another funny writer, James Howard Kunstler. We'll continue the conversation. Do not go away. We'll be right here.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.